There's a storm coming.
You sound like you're looking forward to it.
I'm adaptable.
What are you?
I'm Gotham's Reckoning.
Me about getting into cars with strange men.
This isn't a car.
The man who dons Batman's cape in the Hollywood film The Dark Knight Rises visited Aurora, Colorado, as another perfect stranger affected by the shooting attack inside a theater playing the movie he stars in. Christian Bale showed up with little advance warning, acting on his own accord, visiting victims and thanking first responders for their work. Bale appeared at the makeshift memorial to the 12 victims by the cinema, taking in the somber scene, carrying flowers and paying respects. Bale put the bouquet.
That was a trailer for The Dark Knight Rises, the final installment in Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy, and an excerpt from an Associated Press news story related to this film. As listeners are aware, the premiere for this film was marred by a shooting in Aurora, Colorado. In this Theofantastique podcast, we will be speaking with Dr. Travis Langley, a psychologist and superhero fan, and author of the book Batman and Psychology, A Dark and Stormy Night. We will get Dr. Langley's response to the Colorado shooting and allegations of the Batman film and dark fantasy in general contribute to such acts of violence, as well as his thoughts on superheroes and what we can learn about ourselves in light of them.
Okay. To begin, can you share some of your personal background in psychology, how this overlaps with your interest in comics, and I'm intrigued by how personally a psychologist is also such an in-depth comic fan.
Well, I am a social psychologist. My graduate training was in the psychology of how people interact and are influenced by each other. But over the years, the main thing I've taught is abnormal psychology, the psychology of mental illness. I've probably taught that about 80 times in the last 20 years. Other classes I teach are personality and forensic psychology, the psychology of crime. And every spring I do one media-related course because my interest has always been in media. You know, even with my social psychology background, my graduate work was on the psychology of violence, particularly as it related to the media. You know, my master's thesis and my doctoral dissertation both had to do with, you know, how we think about aggression in the media and how we're influenced by it, how it affects us in the short term, at least in the graduate research. Harder to show long-term effects in terms of how this became connected to my interest in comics. Well, one influence is simply the fact that we have a communication professor at my university, Dr. Randy Duncan, who he has always been, you know, involved in comic scholarship and has tied comics to his work. You know, he's taught a comics as communication course, so he's paved the way here at this university, you know, creating our library's graphic novel room, founding a comic book club. And when my son got involved in those things, I took a greater, you know, interest in that, and I got to feeling more and more like, well, this is what I should have been doing all along, because the interest in the comic books and superheroes in particular has been there my entire life. I got a bit frustrated in the 90s just with some of the stories would be, you know, six-part fight scenes. I got very frustrated with how much marketing had to do with the shape of the stories, and it was kind of disappointing, like even lost part of myself when I wasn't getting comic books very often anymore. But then I got back into it with some particular storylines that I was interested in where they were going, and then very much so as my son got older, I was interested in combining art and storytelling, and comic books are a great medium for that. When the first time he went to Comic-Con, he was doing some data collection as part of research, ethnographic research by Matt Smith, not the Matt Smith who flies in a TARDIS, but Matt Smith who's a professor at another university. And I was like, well, I want to see the presentation that they're going to do about this research. And I went to Comic-Con, and I met other comic scholars, and I saw over 100,000 people in this environment that celebrates their differences. And it just all hit home for me. It's like, I need to study fan culture, and very quickly I need to write a book about Batman in particular. And it makes me feel like I'm the truest I've ever been to myself now that I have combined, you know, these other interests of mine with my professional interest. And it's been, you know, very, very, very good for me personally.
It's wonderful. I wish, hopefully I can get myself in the same position one day.
Well, I've got a colleague of Dr. Andrea Lenamendi who, you know, she had been, you know, unsure. It's like, should she let colleagues know, that your professional colleagues know that about these other interests of hers, the cosplay and the comics. And, you know, it is understandable. It depends on the environment you're in as to how safe it is to talk about these things. And I told her, it's like, well, the sooner you can find a way to combine these interests, the more years you'll have to enjoy it. I'm fortunate being in a department where my chair, you know, appreciates these things as legitimate scholarship. My dean does not understand it, but she trusts us enough to know the best way of teaching our students.
Definitely. Well, I'll come back later on in our interview with some more thoughts on the popularity of comics and fan culture in the Academy, but that's kind of a good way to introduce it. Unfortunately, I need to get your thoughts on the events of Aurora, Colorado, where at the premiere of The Dark Knight Rises, as everyone knows who's been following the news, a masked gunman came in and killed a dozen people and wounded many more. And almost immediately, the media began speculating as to causes. And some of those that are allegedly responsible for the violence included the Batman film in particular, perhaps maybe Batman himself, dark fantasy, as well as some other explanations that have been offered. At this point, what do we really know about the shooter and his motivations, and what causal factors might have been involved?
Oh, that speculation you're talking about. When the tragedy first came up, I was initially going to go offline for the next 3 days. I even tweeted, it's like, okay, I'm just going offline, you know, for the weekend, because you know, I felt odd, you know, promoting, you know, here I was, you know, my psychology of this fictional character, you know, and something that was fun for many individuals, you know, promoting that in connection with this tragedy. But very quickly, I got frustrated by the speculation I saw going on and the things even, you know, professionals were banding about. So I got right back online. One thing in particular, Dr. Drew Pinsky on Headline News called the shooter delusional, based on the shooter's remark, you know, calling himself the Joker. If he really believed that, yes, that's delusional. But we don't know he believes that. We don't know what he means. People shout all kinds of things. You know, people say many things. People call themselves things. That doesn't mean they believe it. You know, this is a young man who has been planning this for months. We know that from the evidence. That's clear. This is clearly documented that he's been amassing the weapons and working on this for at least 2 to 4 months. And somehow managed to pass, you know, for normal enough among the individuals around him. Your truly insane individuals, the people who are truly psychotic, they tend not to be as dangerous as the ones who are just a bit out of touch with reality. The ones who are thoroughly out of touch with reality, they can't pass for normal long enough without raising all kinds of alarms throughout the world around them. You know, the person who is a bit out of touch might get very paranoid about his neighbor and, you know, hide a gun and go over to shoot the neighbor in his paranoia, you know, as opposed to the one who is completely out of touch with reality, who, you know, he's not hiding the gun, he's going over, having an argument with a tree on his way, and, you know, not following a rational plan. You know, this individual who did these things had a very well-developed plan, very thorough. It's, you know, only, possibly only through his informing the police that his apartment was booby-trapped, that the tragedy did not become far worse. And we don't know his reasons on doing that. We can guess, but that's all they are, is guesses. You know, maybe he had a moment of clarity and realized he didn't want that to happen. Maybe he had remorse after what had just happened. Or maybe he liked the idea of making them afraid for what was going to happen when they went onto that apartment. You know, there are good and bad reasons. There are healthy and unhealthy reasons. We can't make assumptions about any of them. We know this is one disturbed individual. We do know that, but we don't know what kind of disturbed individual he is. We can say certain things based on the evidence. We can make guesses based on the history of mass murderers. We do know from the history of mass murderers, these individuals tend to be, you know, people who, you know, bottle up their anger, bottle up their feelings, you know, have not coped well with the world around them, and when some particular thing goes wrong in life that, you know, makes them feel like failures, they don't believe they should feel like failures. They want to take it out on the rest of the world, have an impact to prove to the world, here they are, I'm matter, no matter what it takes. And any fool can become famous in an instant. Anybody can go out and do some horrible thing. It is easy. He did it in a more complicated way, but he still did, you know, something that very, very quickly made him famous. It's more trouble to find the heroic thing, to find the good thing that will make you famous. It's either a fluke of timing or, you know, a lot more work. And these tend to be individuals who don't know how to do good, the good thing, and may lack the empathy or motivation to do the good thing. They tend to be short on their understanding of other people. And there's a lot of things that we do know about him that suggest that he has related very poorly to people throughout his life, you know, that he hasn't known how, you know, to interact with other people well. In terms of his choice of the movie theater, there's nothing in his history to suggest that the movies inspired him to do this particular deed. One, he had not seen The Dark Knight Rises, so it wouldn't have driven him to do it. And the character of the Joker that he was calling himself for the previous one, and then he at least had enough information to leave a message on his answering machine or voicemail, whichever it is. You know, it's like doing a Joker voice that disturbed, you know, the owner of a gun range, who was trying to follow up on whether they should allow this person to target practice there. Okay, he had some interest, and his interest in the media may have affected the shape of what he did. It may, you know, his personal interest in that may have affected his location. But why was he interested in this? These individuals tend to choose locations or settings that are personally meaningful for them. They may choose random locations. They may choose some place that just simply looks like it's the place to get the most people at, you know, one time. And that's Roger Ebert's argument on part of why this guy chose that one setting. You know, they do, they're more often going to choose personally meaningful settings. And this film appears to be personally meaningful for him. But that doesn't mean the film caused it any more than if, you know, he went to a bakery, which, you know, was personally meaningful because a friend of his worked there, or because a girlfriend had broken up with him at that location. It doesn't mean, you know, donuts caused him to do this thing. It doesn't mean the bakery chain caused him to do this thing. You know, we have no evidence that the media caused him to do this.
One follow-up question related to this particular aspect of it. How similar is this and the attempts to come up with some kind of causal explanation or influence, is it to similar things in the past? For example, in relation to the fantastic and pop culture in previous generations, it was alleged that horror comics caused teen violence and juvenile delinquency. Then as you move forward, it's supposedly video games, and now dark fantasy is supposedly to blame. From good data, what do we really know about such connections? And perhaps the bigger question is, why do human beings have this desire to try and come up with some kind of simple, manageable cause for seemingly unfathomable events?
Okay, two questions. Both could have really long answers while I forget one question answering the other. So why do we seek these, why do we seek these causes, and what do we know from the data? In terms of data, we can show that media will affect people in the short run. You know, right after people watch a really aggressive film, they tend to be more aggressive right afterwards. But even that depends on their personalities and their emotional response to it. People who are predisposed to be repulsed by that material do not become more aggressive afterwards. So it's something that's already in them in the first place, even with that short-term reaction. We've got this long history of blaming the media throughout the entire age of communication. You know, blaming comic books, particularly horror comics, although, you know, Frederick Wortham, the biggest voice in that opposition, he also, you know, threw in some, you know, jabs at superhero comics in one particular chapter in his book, Seduction of the Innocent, in 1954, and it rattled the entire comic book industry. It led to the creation of the Comics Code Authority and more self-regulation by the industry because they were worried about the effects that the media could have. We can't say there's no effect, but we don't know to what degree the media is affecting reality and reality is shaping the media. The, you know, rock and roll music got blamed, music videos got blamed, rap music got blamed, video games got blamed. And to a large extent, there's a serious lack of good evidence on the relationship, you know, between violence and the proliferation of these items. Video games, for example, as video game sales go up, violent crime goes down. That doesn't mean one's causing the other, but it certainly would fly in the face of anybody who wants to argue a causal relationship in the opposite direction. So there's a serious lack of good empirical evidence, because how do you do an experiment with all of psychology, with all of society? You know, how do you, you know, put, you know, 1 million people in your experiment to see what happens after they, you know, have a lifetime of being exposed to these films, as opposed to 1 million people who you don't let them see them? You cannot logically, ethically, morally, you know, do these experiments when they'll shape people that way. So it's a very difficult and practical kind of thing to study. Correlational evidence is just that. You know, just because two variables correlate doesn't prove one causes the other. You know, people who eat oatmeal have a higher cancer rate. That doesn't prove oatmeal causes cancer, doesn't prove cancer makes you want to eat oatmeal. The thing that seems to tie them together is that the age, older people eat more oatmeal and older people get more cancer. So even when you see correlations between the media and violent crime, doesn't prove one's causing the other. So the evidence is weak in terms of being able to show long-term effects. Why do we want these causes? Why do we want these explanations? The world is a scary, chaotic place. A recurring theme throughout all of social psychology is that the world is a scary, chaotic place, and we'll go to great lengths to make it seem less scary, more orderly, more understandable than it really is. We either want to understand things or convince ourselves we do understand things. Complex causality is confusing. Recognizing that there are a million variables that, you know, shape one particular thing, a million variables that shape one individual. And it's like, well, then you don't get the feeling of understanding what's going on. So you want something to pin down. You want someone to blame. Then the more horrifying the event is, the more spectacular an event is. You know, the more horrifying or spectacular we want the explanations to be. It really unnerves people when there's a simple explanation for something complicated. We want cause to transcend effect. It's the reason people will believe in conspiracy theories. Our age, you see some people throwing out some conspiracy ideas that the government's behind this shooting. That's nonsense. There is no reason to believe that. Conspiracies do happen in the world, but we also know from history that people are really lousy at keeping them secret. Assuming the government was behind it assumes a degree of competence the government has not been shown to have. The world needs to make sense to us. And that ends up making us make some irrational decisions to feel like it makes sense. This event is so horrible, blaming just this one guy. He's not big enough to hold the amount of blame that we want to cast. So we've got to cast it upon something else and somewhere else. And, you know, the film being there becomes the immediate focus, becomes the immediate target. It's what is obvious to it to us and salient. It's in our faces.
Well, let's shift to something a little more positive. You were the author of the intriguing book, Batman and Psychology, A Dark and Stormy Night.
Yes.
And how did you come up with the idea to apply your psychological training to the figure of Batman?
It started with a class I was teaching a few years ago. The summer I first went to Comic-Con, the month before Comic-Con, I'd be teaching class psychology and literature. And I gave my students assignments. They each had to choose some literary character. Most chose, you know, some older ones like Captain Ahab or Hamlet. You know, someone chose more recent like Dumbledore. They each had to analyze that character a number of different ways throughout the semester and then, you know, end up writing a paper looking into the psyche of that character. And so they would analyze, you know, it was like, rate your character on this Machiavellian scale and write a paragraph, you know, explaining why you rated them that way. Rate how extroverted or introverted they are. And I would give them examples of how to do their assignments by rating Batman, you know, my childhood hero, and the character I knew well. And so, and also a character they knew. You know, if I chose something like Captain Ahab for the example of how to do these, well, they wouldn't all know the character. You know, it was perfectly fine for a student to analyze Ahab, but not the best example for me to use when showing them. So it helped for me to use a character that was more famous. And, you know, a character, you know, I knew well. In the course of writing those examples, well, I just kept writing. I knew it's like, boy, I could easily write an entire article, and I could easily write more than an article on this. And so I knew I wanted. I knew very quickly that summer that I wanted to write a book about Batman. I also knew that that wasn't the time to do it because I didn't have you know, the connections and the experience of the comic scholarship. I needed to spend more time, you know, getting to know the field and begin immersing myself in the field, which I enjoyed doing anyway and felt like I should have been doing longer than that. So I wrote a journal article analyzing a storyline for Marvel Comics, what they call the Civil War, and, you know, built other connections. And I even mentioned to the other comic scholars, it's like, this is what I want to do. I want to write about Batman in his belfry. And the following summer, I got to do a panel looking at the psychology of the Joker, you know, with another psychologist, and Michael Uslan, executive producer of every Batman movie since the 80s. He's also a comic scholar himself. So he joined us. Adam West joined us to talk about Cesar Romero's work in the role. Jerry Robinson, creator of the Joker, was on that panel, and Steve Englehart, a comic book writer who had written a particularly important take on the Joker, which is incredibly influential on the Batman films, far more than most people realize. And, you know, that was the start of me every summer, you know, doing panels on the psychology of characters related to Batman. We looked at, you know, how Batman works with sidekicks and partners one year. Last year, we looked at Batman's love life. This year, we looked at, you know, what would it take to break Batman, particularly tying it into the villains for the movie. And last year, the spring of last year, I knew it was about as close as we could get to the release for The Dark Knight Rises, you know, for me to get the book in motion. So I got myself a literary agent. I got an agent in 4 days based on the strength of the concept and the credentials that I'd built up at that point. And we had the sale of the book within 2 weeks. Two publishers in particular really wanted it. And I'm very happy with the publisher we've gone with. Wiley has been great. I've enjoyed working with them. And, you know, now we're trying to figure out what I'm doing next. It certainly helps that my book has been selling well for the last month. Terms of time, what will we do next? I'd like to do a Spider-Man book, although, you know, we just had the movie, so we're probably 3 years away on that one. I would like to do a Superman book, but they've got a Superman philosophy book coming out in connection with the next movie. It's like, well, okay, you like some of my ideas. Now we have to figure out what I'm doing now. But right now, I'm enjoying talking about Batman and related issues.
Well, having spent a lot of time psychologically in Batman's belfry, what kind of conclusions came out. Did anything strike you as being unusual or striking to you in psychologically analyzing The Dark Knight?
Well, with this book, I mean, psychology, it's the book is Batman and psychology, not psychology of Batman, because I'm using psychology to analyze Batman, but I'm also using Batman to teach psychology. So I wandered through a number of different aspects of psychology. You know, we get to talk about mental illness, you know, particularly in terms of how it relates to a number of his enemies. But we do have to look at possibly what would Batman qualify for. You know, does he qualify for PTSD? That's the big one so many people think he must fit. He definitely has some symptoms, but every professional I know, you know, who knows the character and knows the qualifications for PTSD, you know, agrees he does not have that. The particular criteria, they don't fit him functioning as well as he does at the things he wants to do in life. You know, he definitely has some symptoms, but not the disorder itself. And that's one of the nice things about using this fiction to teach the psychology, not just the psychology to analyze the fiction. I can use something like Batman and go through the criteria for PTSD and showing, okay, here's how he fits this. Here's how he fits depending on which version of the story we have. This one he does not fit, and get people to think about PTSD a little more complexly than they would have thought about it otherwise and realize, oh, there's a bit more to it. And it's easier for them to think about it with this fictional character, which they know somewhat, than if I were talking about a real person that they might not know at all, or even a real person who's very famous that we still don't know what goes on in that person's head. With Batman, we can see his thought bubbles. With a real person, I'm looking at Ted Bundy, I cannot see his thought bubbles. Anything he ever tells us about anything he's ever had to think, he could be lying to us. Bundy did a lot of that. You know, if we want to look at villains, our greatest source of information about what goes on in the villains is, you know, each villain himself or herself, and we can't trust what they have to tell us. You know, with the fictional villains, we can look at what's in print and their history, and, you know, over 70 years of history with some of them. With heroes, real-life heroes, it's not always fair for me to go through and, you know, judge a real individual I've never met and make guesses about that person and that person's family and lives and who's been affected by them. It can be utterly unfair. With a fictional character, I have the freedom to do that, and Bruce Wayne cannot sue me. That's a big one, of course, is that Bruce Wayne can't sue me. Although I commented on that to Len Wein, a comic book writer who created Lucius Fox and Wolverine, and Len said, I wouldn't put it past Bruce Wayne to find a way to do it, though. The filter of fiction lets people look at some of the most horrible things in life without being utterly repulsed or feeling voyeuristic. If you were reading about the life of a real individual who lost his family at age 8, or, you know, Judith Leitner, who lost her daughter, you know, to a drunk driver and went on to found Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, as it was originally called, or any of these other people who had horrible things, you go into the gritty details of the horrible part, you know, it can be repulsive and the person can turn away from it. But looking through it through the fiction, they can learn about some of the worst things in the world without, you know, turning away from it as readily or feeling like there's something, you know, cruel and voyeuristic about doing it. So that's one of the nice things about doing that. You know, the opening sentence of my book is, Adam West once asked me if I thought Batman was crazy. Batman and Psychology, A Dark and Stormy Night is my answer. And at the end of the book, I come back to that, book ending it from how it started. And ultimately, the answer I gave him for, you know, is Batman crazy? Not for the world in which he lives. What he does is definitely unusual and extreme, and there may be better ways of going about some of the things he wants to do, but the fiction always creates a world in which there is a need for somebody to do this unusual, bizarre thing. You know, there are places in the world where people do need to wear a mask to stand up for justice, or corrupt officials will lock them away and their families may vanish. You know, there are times when people need to do, you know, something really unusual and bizarre. There are times when people need to wear a mask and create a symbol that will spread and inspire others. And what the writers have done each time, they've created, you know, Tim Burton's noirish Gotham City and Nolan's incredibly corrupt Gotham City, you know, based on Frank Miller's corrupt Gotham City, to give us a world where there is a reason for this man to be doing these things that in our world would be utterly crazy.
Well, thank you for the psychological insights. I'll have to wear those spectacles the next time. I still haven't seen The Dark Knight Rises. Maybe I'll pick up on a few things when I watch the film. But you got The Dark Knight out now. We just said Spider-Man. You have the Iron Man film before that. Superheroes are everywhere.
Yeah.
Not only in comics and graphic novels, but film and television. What does our explosion in interest in comic superheroes, what does that say psychologically about American society?
Well, I think one thing is simply that CGI makes it possible to have those films where we didn't have them before. And so many things with CGI just don't live up to the effects. It's like, why in the world do you have to have a CGI alien when, you know, the guy in the rubber suit works so much better in the movie Alien? So superhero movies, you know, they love practical effects, Jon Favreau and Christopher Nolan, but there are times when the CGI is necessary and lets things happen that we just never could have seen before. But it's a growing thing throughout the whole age of communication. You know, it's like science fiction, you know, having its popularity and the world getting nerdier in some ways. We've got the internet. We've got, you know, all sorts of things where the geeks are inheriting the earth. You know, it's a nerdier world than it used to be. And some of the restraints against doing the nerdy thing, you know, aren't there. In the 70s, when I was a kid, you know, Fonzie taught the world that a nerd was the worst thing to be. You know, now people proudly call themselves nerds. And so in that area, you know, it just simply reflects that people can be more open with their nerdiness. But, you know, you see the growing popularity of something like Comic-Con. You see the ways in which fantastic things are creeping into the culture everywhere. You know, World of Warcraft and all these other fantastic things, you know, can now happen where they couldn't happen before because of technological reasons. And they're creating ways for people to share interests that might have died out before they could communicate with each other. You know, 40 years ago, somebody, you know, is interested in a fantasy novel living in a small town in the middle of nowhere and has nobody to share it with. Now they can go online and share these interests and let them grow and become even bigger than before. You know, there's been something freeing about it. It's also been seen over time that, you know, fantastic fiction becomes more popular during times of frustration, during times of economic crisis. You know, if the economy reached a point of being, you know, more stable and more stress-free, if that's even possible, we might see a decline in the interest in fantastic fiction. You know, sci-fi sells better when the economy is worse. People go to the movies more when the economy is worse, which, you know, can seem, you know, contradictory when the more money is getting spent somewhere. It's a matter of what they're choosing. So escapism is part of it, but it's not just wanting to escape from reality. It's wanting to have more fun within the reality that we're in. You know, it becomes part of people's lives and things that they can share and enjoy, you know, where they couldn't before.
Well, Dr. Langley, I thank you for contributing to both nerd culture and to the scholarly world and the academic exploration of these things. And I'm glad to see that your word is getting out there, perhaps being boosted by this unfortunate tragedy. But I appreciate the voice and the wisdom and the contribution that you're making to this and taking the time out to answer these questions for this podcast.
Oh, I'm glad to talk about these things. And glad to talk with you.